Hey, this is Russell Holbrook, and you're listening to my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say
you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Dominate.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man, being realistic.
As the story grows.
I always wanted to be part of a small rebellion.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it. Boom.
I mean, let's just start from the beginning, or relatively the beginning. Did you grow up, spend your whole life in Georgia?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And I only moved away for 5 years when I lived in Chapel Hill, North Carolina from 99 to 2004. That was almost 5 years exactly that I lived there.
That's cool. What was growing up like?
Oh, it was cool. I mean, it was normal. Like, I had a really good childhood. Like, all the relatives, like, lived close together, and everyone was in, like, the Austell, Mableton, Marietta area, and we used to have, like, huge get-togethers, and, like, every holiday we would all get together, and that lasted pretty much up until I was about 18, when my dad's mother, you know, my Nana, when she passed, the family kind of lost that, you know, close-knit quality, and everyone, then the kids all got older and, you know, started their own families and all that stuff, but it was really cool, and, like, I did grow up sheltered and, like a serious religious household, and but I was always loved and, like, really cared for, and I was allowed to watch HBO, even though I still feel like I was sheltered, you know, and but I had, like, HBO and MTV, and I only remember, like, a couple of, there was an argument over, oh, I started an argument with my parents once because I tricked my mom into buying me the Twisted Sister album that my dad had not let me buy, and they were pretty, like, open and cool about stuff, and definitely good parents. I really believe they, like, did the best they could, you know. So
yeah, that's cool. How did you get into music, just from watching MTV or?
No, I just grew up with it. My grandma had, like, a stack of 45s that my cousin and I got into. It's kind of cliche, but the first rock and roll I ever heard was Elvis. And I was, like, I was a little kid, and my cousin was a couple years older, and he knew how to operate the little turntable in her back room. And so we like, went through these 45s, and I loved that Elvis song, Big Boss Man. It's kind of up-tempo, but I thought it was, like, really fast, and I was like, whoa, this is crazy. And then I think when I was 7, I saw, well, then MTV came out, and I saw the video for Bang Your Head by Quiet Riot, and that was what changed everything. But prior to that, I liked Kiss. Like, I had seen Kiss on TV, and I liked AC/DC. I heard them on the radio, but when that Quiet Riot video, like, solidified my love for music, because it, like, totally stirred something within me that was new, and it was just so exciting. So then I went, like, I really got into music, particularly, like, rock, like heavy rock music. But I'd always been around music. My mom was in the church choir. There was a piano in the house. They both played. And they would just, like, sit around playing piano in the evening. And it was just, like, always a part of life, you know?
That's cool. That's cool. When did you start playing guitar?
Got my guitar when I was, I think for my 12th birthday, my parents finally broke down and bought me a guitar after I had been pestering them for 2 or 3 years at least. I even had made a cardboard guitar that I could play like air guitar to Quiet Riot to. And, my dad tried to get me into piano, but I wasn't really digging it, and, yeah, they got me the guitar when I was 12. I'm pretty sure it was my 12th birthday. They bought me a BC Rich Rave. Yeah, but, there's this guy, one of the music guys at my church, his name was Sonny Lauderstedt, and he played in an old Christian group called the Pat Terry Group, and he and my dad took me out to, like, guitar shopping, the three of us. So that was, like, really special, you know. I'll never forget that. It was awesome.
That's and then, cool.
And, you know, the Rave was, like, one step down from the Warlock, so it had that weird angular shape.
a true metal guitar.
Yeah.
So I know from your the Joe Christmas bio that you and Zach have been playing together. How did you meet Zach? Just in high school, or?
Yes, yeah, we met in ninth grade. We were sitting across from one another in an English class, and this other kid was talking about some rap album, and I said, I don't like that, it disrespects women. And he was like, no, it doesn't. Well, you're dumb. What kind of music do you like? And I went, I like Christian metal. And then Zach said he heard me say that, and his ears perked up. And then right after class, we started talking about bands, and like everything from like Vengeance Rising to the Choir was discussed. And it turned out he had an older cousin who was really into Christian rock and like knew all the underground stuff, and was also into like Daniel Amos and some of the older like alternative bands. And Zach was more into like alternative stuff, and he was really into blues. And I was just all about like metal and hardcore. And then, you know, and all the types of metal. And then we like bonded over that, and that's how we became friends. And then I think at the time he sang and played harmonica. And so we may have started playing music either that year we started the band in 10th grade. So I think we did some jams in like 9th grade, you know, just I would play these blues progressions on my VC Rich Rave with the distortion on it, and he would like play the harmonica and sing. Yeah, it was fun. But yeah, that was how that started.
That's cool. So you through Joe Christmas, it was you and Zach in a band, and there's a great list of band names on your Facebook page. The Subliminal Neckties, Speedy Delivery, and Cran Before Joe Christmas.
Yes.
You avoided... I mean, Subliminal Neckties is pretty good, but there's no terrible band names on that. Those aren't so bad.
Well, thank you.
At what point did you guys hook up with Ryan? add him to the picture.
That was also in 10th grade, because he, I don't know if he was going to our school yet. He might have still been at his other high school, because he transferred at some point, but, Brian, I think he already had a bass guitar and Zach brought him in, because we just wanted to form a band for the talent show, and my cousin Brad was gonna do the vocals, but his mom was really against it because she thought that he would be like embarrass everyone. There's like a story behind that I can't quite recount at the moment, or I can't recall of it, but he ended up not wanting to do it, and so I asked, and I was already, like, there was already Ryan and our friend Jason Lee was playing the drums, and so we just decided to ask Zach, because, like, Zach was always there, and we were always hanging out together, knew he could sing, and so then it ended up being the four of us, and we did the talent show in the spring of 92, and that was our very first performance together. We played a song called You're Special to Me, which is based on a little monologue by Mr. Rogers.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So I did not realize this until just looking up the Joe Christmas bio, that you guys didn't initially sign to Tooth & Nail, that you guys signed to Flying Tart, and then they sold your record and then the band essentially to Tooth & Nail. So I guess, how'd you guys get hooked up with Flying Tart? And then what was it like being moved to Tooth & Nail like that?
Well, the guy who owned Flying Tart, his name was Alex. He saw us play at a festival called Inner Seeds, which used to be held here in Atlanta. And, then he contacted Zach and offered, and Zach was at school in Athens, and I was at school in Macon, and he just talked about it with Zach and offered us a deal, and then we jumped at it without even, like, reading the contract or anything. You know, typical, like, 18-year-old, thing to do. And then we did the whole record in Nashville on the weekends in February of 95. This is the story I heard secondhand, is that Alex sent a copy of it to Brandon Evil, and he was taunting him, saying, "Look at what I have that you don't." And then Brandon was like, "Oh, I'm gonna get that, I'm gonna get that band." And then they made a deal. But another factor, something I heard later, was that one of the guys from, maybe it was Blenderhead, one of those guys was in the office and they were listening to the record, and I think it may have been Evan. He was like, "Man, this is great. You gotta, like, sign this band." And so, there was a confluence of events. Some stuff happened, and then we had to discuss it as a band, whether we wanted to take the deal or not, and there was, like, a little bit of hesitancy, as because we knew that that was going to pretty much solidify us, like, as a, like, we were going to get deeper in the Christian scene, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was some concern about that, because Flying Tart was so small, and it was also kind of operating in both camps, I believe, like Christian and secular. And, we just, like, decided to do it. I remember having a discussion about it before a show one time, and we were like, "Yeah, let's do it." It just seemed like a good step, like a positive step forward, and, like, more exposure, and we felt like we'd get some tours and stuff, and so it was, it was kind of surreal, because Zach and I were friends with the dudes in Luxury, and we had been at Cornerstone with them when they got signed, and, like, I remember hearing Chris recount that on his episode. like, that was, like, really weird to be, because I was, like, kind of envious and, like, man, they're so lucky, you know, when are we going to get a record deal? And Tooth and Nail is awesome, and that would be cool. And then we got hooked up with them, and it was very exciting, you know, despite the hesitancy about the Chris being perceived as, like, a Christian band and stuff. I think that was a very minor and fleeting, like, fear.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, it sounds like the trade-off of being with the label was bigger than not being with the label. But I was going to ask, if there was any sort of expectation there of what the band would be if you signed with them, and it sounds like there was briefly.
Yeah, there was. I mean, because we had some difficulty, like, early on with people who criticized us pretty harshly because we didn't say anything. Like, there was no proselytizing from the stage, and it was all our shows were goofy and manic, and we used to throw things at the audience and bring, like, chips and giant pickles and throw them at people and we would dress in drag, and like a lot of people like got really upset about all that. And but then once we were signed on Tooth and Nail, like people were like, oh, you guys are great, and it was this whole turnaround. It was really weird, but that was how the concern was, because we never said, you know, we're like a ministry or something. We, you know, if anything is the ministry, it's just that you can get joy from the music. That was what we were thinking, you know?
Yeah. Scott Hatch from Burnt Toast Vinyl told me that he had talked to, Philip, the drummer, who didn't realize, I guess he told Hatch he didn't realize the band was a Christian band until he picked up a copy of CCM Magazine while recording the first record.
Yeah, that, like, Phyllis and I were friends at college, and our original drummer had just, like, you know, we had lost touch with him because he just stopped coming to practice. And we felt like he was kind of ignoring us, and we didn't understand what was going on. So I just asked Philip if he would help us with the record, and he said he would love to. And I think we just practiced for a couple of weeks before. When we went to the studio, like, we all the songs weren't even finished yet, you know?
Yeah.
And, I should have said something as far as like what, letting him know what he was getting into, but I didn't say anything. There was like no explanation, and like he was from more of a like an open kind of, like, his parents didn't make him go to church growing up and all that, and he was actually unfamiliar with like the whole underground Christian scene that Dak and Ryan and I had been into for years, you know?
Yeah. What was it like in those early days? I mean, it's still kind of the wild, wild west of Christian music in those days. And, it was starting to become a little more structured with Tooth and Nail there, but outside of like the festivals, what were like shows like in touring for you guys?
They would usually be like really small, but it would just depend on like where we were and who put the show on. I think the most important element was like the who organized it, you know?
Okay.
Like, I remember playing a coffee house in Mississippi, I think, and there were like four or five people there, and then we played this basement show at some guy's house, and I think we were in Virginia, but we were deep in the woods. I have no idea where we were, and it was like packed. There were like the basement was just packed full of people, and it was awesome. That was like one of the best shows. And then one time these guys who were teenagers organized a show in, it was in Ohio. I don't remember the name of the town, but it was in Ohio, and, that show was amazing because there were probably like 30 or 40 people there, but everyone was singing along. And like, it was like really emotionally stirring, you know, and it was like really cool. And, so it just depended, you know, I mean, there would be like pockets of people, you know, who were like really into the stuff, and like, we would, playing churches was strange, especially if like a pastor was present and they would start asking a bunch of questions. Like, this one guy was like, "So, did y'all meet at church?" And I was like, no. Well, you know, but I don't know. I mean, it was different, you know. Some of the venues were odd, and we played in, like, church gymnasiums and basements and just really wherever, you know, strange clubs and coffee houses, but we got to play some well-established clubs too. So it just depends, and like some of the tour like scheduling was really erratic, but we didn't do much touring. You know, after we recorded the second album, we went straight on the road. We were gone from home for like 3 months, I think, but like Zachary had booked some dates. And then we picked up other dates as we went along, and we kind of worked with the Tooth & Nail booking agency, and it was really sporadic, but it was almost like being on a vacation where we just drove around the country and played every 3 or 4 days. Sometimes we went like a week without playing a show. There was this one, we ended up like, when we played CMJ, we spent a week in upstate New York at a campground that was closed for the season, and there was some sort of family connection, but we stayed there and practiced for a week, and we ended up playing a show at the local dive bar where they like had to hang a microphone from the ceiling for Zach because there was no mic stand.
Oh, wow.
And it, like, weird stuff like that, you know, and it was a lot of fun, you know. I wish that we had toured more, but the last tour we did, Zach put it together himself, and we played like every day for like a week or so, or maybe 2 weeks, and it was just, it was really awesome, you know.
That's cool. You guys recorded your second record with Bob Weston. What was that like?
Oh, it was an amazing experience. Like, that guy is so talented, you know.
Yeah.
And we were super excited because we recorded at Electrical Audio, and at that time it was located in Steve Albini's basement. And you'd track down in the basement, and then the control room was in the attic. And, it was just a really great experience. Like, Zach did a lot of the overdubs with one of the guitars that Kurt Cobain had used on In Utero.
Uh-huh.
And we were totally enamored with both Bob Weston and Steve Albini because they had, done, like, a lot, you know, several of our favorite records. And particularly, like, Bob Weston did, he recorded with the Archers of Loathe. And, like, I loved that band. And, you know, they were really keen on, like, drum sounds and stuff and kind of, experimenting but still getting, like, a live feel. you know, more of like how the band sounds live. And we were just really into that whole aesthetic. And it was like, it's a really wonderful experience, you know.
Yeah. Was that something you guys had worked out as a band or the label had put together for you? Or?
Oh, we requested to work with them. And we originally like asked to work with Steve Albini, but he was busy at the time. And so Bob Weston, I guess, was kind of the house engineer, but we knew him, you know, from those albums that we loved. And so they were like, Bob's available. And we were like, oh, yes, yes, please. And but we, yeah, we like pursued that because we had done the first record with Chris Colbert and Steve Hindelong, and that was in Nashville. Alex from Flying Tart had set that up, but we were like stoked about that because, you know, Steve is from the choir and Chris is from Fluffy and Breakfast with Amy and, Plague of Ethels and all that. And then we, but we wanted to do things differently on the second album. I think at the time we were thinking we would do every record with somebody different. So everyone, and I think the third one we were even going to try to do at home, like by ourselves, but that never materialized, you know? So we pursued that, and thankfully, you know, Brandon paid for it. Which still blows my mind. I was like, really? You're going to pay for this? Wow.
It seems like reception to your band now, like a lot of people, I mean, love Joe Christmas, at least that I see on like Facebook and the Old School Tooth and Nail page. I mean, was the reception at the time, did you feel that at the time, or is it like, you know, post Joe Christmas that all this love came for the band?
Huh. Well, I think that, I think we did feel it at the time, and certainly I remember there would be certain times where like I would meet someone who expressed their, you know, affection for the band and stuff, and I would be really blown away. And then I don't know, it seems more visible now for some reason, because we felt left out a lot of the time because we didn't preach and we didn't try to have a quote unquote ministry. And it seemed like you did better back then. You know, I remember one time, we were sitting at Cornerstone and no one was coming to our table, but the OC Supertones table was like covered with people, and we were all envious and like, man, why does anybody like us? You know, and like, what's wrong? What did we do wrong? And you know what I mean? That's the trap of comparing instead of identifying, and like, not just being grateful for what you have. But yeah, I think at the time we did feel kind of like the odd man out, so to speak, you know, and especially the second time we played Cornerstone, I felt like really isolated, you know, and, it was weird, but I'm so grateful now to hear that people still enjoy the music, because we used to talk about that back then. It's like we wanted to make something that had like a lasting quality and that could, you know, be enjoyed like years later. But we didn't know how to like consciously do that, but we were like, Yeah, I hope we can do that. And
yeah, it's like as people have gotten older and like the records have aged well and people have a fonder view or understanding of the music than they did then, and like, you know, where maybe the Supertones record, those lyrics or whatever haven't aged as well, or because of the ska thing was such a blip on the radar, it's just not, not to talk shit about the Supertones band.
Right. But I mean, you know, you can, to me anyway, like all those records I loved back then, I still love now. Like I love Teenage Politics. Like, oh my God, man, that's like brilliant. I'll forever love that album. And like the first two Starfire records, and like also I'm like a lifelong Joy Electric fan, you know, and those were my bands like back then. And I still totally dig those guys, and I've like explored, you know, newer Tooth and Nail bands to an extent, not as much as I'd like to, but I think one was called As Cities Burn.
Yeah.
I really like them, and I love Demon Hunter. Like, I just like, think they're fantastic, and Training for Utopia, of course, and Deo, and there's so much like good stuff, you know. But I'm really grateful that people like remember us and still talk about us, and it's like really cool, very grateful.
Yeah. So one of the things Scott Hatch told me when I told him you were coming on the show, he said he had booked Joe Christmas to play Drexel, and then after the show, you and Zach had gone out to score some weed, and it horrified him, which is one of those like controversial Tooth and Nail stories that's out there about Joe Christmas getting in trouble for smoking weed in church parking lots.
Yeah. Oh, Drexel, that was in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that night, man, was like, that wasn't a very enjoyable experience, because we ended up, we were somewhere downtown, like, just like, I think we were in a student area just asking random people if they knew where to get weed, and we ended up talking to this guy who seemed like he might be homeless, and he said he was going to help us out, and then we didn't give him any money, but I think Philip gave him a shirt, and then like he just disappeared, and we waited and waited and waited, and I just remember sitting outside of some like student union cafe or something that resembled that, and then yeah, we never got any weed that night, but one time we played a house show in Vancouver, and we just asked the guy who lived there, like, hey, do you have any weed? And he's like, oh, what? I thought you guys were a Christian band. And he started laughing, and like, we were like, yeah, but we smoke weed too, and then I forgot what the conversation was, and then we ended up, they had some like really good stout beer that we had, and they didn't have any weed though. But yeah, I mean, we did, I feel bad that we horrified that guy, like, Scott, but I'm sorry, Scott, but like, yeah, we did do that, that's true. When, like, we were church kids, you know, when we got signed, we had gotten to the point of where we were, like, really interested in girls and experimenting with drinking and drugs. And, I mean, at least I can really only speak for myself. But, like, I left church when I was 18 and decided I was going to try all the things that I had been told not to try and do the things that I've been told not to do for my whole life, you know, and kind of go the opposite way of just, you know, see what the world was like. And then, I mean, years later, it turned out really bad for me. But but anyway, at the time, like, we were still in the Christian music scene, you know, and we were playing Christian shows. And so there was this kind of, like, duality, I guess. And then later on, that just kept growing. You know, I grew into an active addiction, and Ryan rediscovered his spirituality and his relationship with God, and that deepened, and so there was that rift. But you know, Ryan was just always kind and compassionate, and he never preached or you guys shouldn't be doing that or anything like that. I just had this inner turmoil, and I was conflicted, and there was also the rift of physical distance, because Zach and Phyllis lived in Athens and Ryan and I lived in Mableton, and Ryan and I were interested in playing stuff more along the lines of the first record, and we wanted to tune the guitars down, and we had this idea of playing stuff that was heavy yet really poppy and melodic and really driving, you know. And then Zach and Philip wanted to play stuff that was a bit more quiet and psychedelic, and Ryan and I wanted to tour constantly. We wanted to go on tour as long as possible, then come home and immediately make a record and then start the cycle over. And then Zach and Philip were more interested in staying in Athens and all of us being in one town and just working on crafting songs, you know, together and spending time together. And Ryan and I would be well, we can write songs on the road and blah, blah, blah. And we're just we would bicker about that and, you know, about just the cliche, musical direction, blah, blah, blah. And so there are several factors, you know, and I think that if we had all been in the same town, you know, and been more on the same wavelength, it would have gone differently. And then, of course, you know, the drug use didn't help any, certainly not on my part, you know, and I was starting to come unraveled, but I was hiding it from everyone. And I was also getting deeper into depression. And so I think all of that stuff worked together. So it was a lot more than just growing up and growing apart, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll jump ahead since we're on the topic. You have a new book, out today, called Heroin is the Answer, a memoir of what I can remember. What made you want to chronicle your story?
Initially it was my wife's idea. And I mean, so people have told me before that I had interesting stories and that that it would be good to write them down, you know, and then, I also write bizarro horror, which has a really small niche audience, and
yeah, I want to get into that, too, because I'm interested in that.
Okay, but Dana was that's so tiny. Why don't you write something more relatable? And I was I guess I could write about my life. And she's yeah, you have a really interesting story. And then that sat in my mind for a long time, and probably a couple of years, and then I decided one day to start doing it, and then I was really resistant, and then I would chip away at it and then put it away for weeks or months at a time and then go back to it, and it was so uncomfortable until one day I got in the flow of it, and it was something that I wanted to do. And then my mindset changed, and I thought, you know, this, I'm going to tell my story and maybe it'll help someone, or maybe it'll help me, or who knows, I'm just going to do it, you know. And now that it's come out, the Kindle version's been out for a couple of days, and I've been talking to some people, and I feel you know, in recovery, it's important to, service is really important. So I'm starting to see that this is kind of part of my service, you know, and maybe, I don't know, but it's it started out as just as my wife's idea to try to write something more relatable and not totally weird and disgusting and I'm really grateful that I went through with it though, because after I got to a certain point, all the pieces started to fall together, and it was kind of like making a record. It just came together, and different elements coalesced, and, you know, it just came to be finally a, like, complete project. So, that's pretty much the story behind that.
That's cool, man. How long have you been sober?
Oh, 6.5 years now.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I got into recovery, like, really got into it in 2007. Prior to that, I had tried to do it myself a few times, but then I knew I had to have help, and so I got into it in 2007, and then it was kind of sketchy or touch and go until 2012, and I've been, like, really sober since then. And, I'll have 7 years in July, like, you know, God willing.
That's cool.
Thank you.
So, did you do any musical projects post Joe Christmas?
I did. I was in Ryan and his brother Josh had a band called World Against World, and I played keyboard with them for a little while, but I was like, I couldn't stay clean, so I had to leave that band. And then I moved to North Carolina in 99, and I was in a band there called Choose Your Own Adventure. And it was like a post-rock kind of experimental, like 12-minute instrumental songs kind of thing. And I did that. You know, we made 3 albums, and we toured some. Like, we got to play the 930 Club in D.C. and pretty rad. And then I came back here and I played, that was in 2004, and I played drums in my friend Brad's garage band until 2006, I think. And that was called Coffin Pound, and those guys are involved in the whole, like, underground garage punk scene, and you know, they knew, like, Jay Retard up in Memphis and all those, and the people that were into that scene. So that was neat. And now I'm in a band that's just a dark ambient noise trio. That's called Ibofanga. And that's just a sheer, like, experimental group, because we don't even practice. We just get together and play, you know, and it's all improv, like, 100% of the time. And, except sometimes I'll have, like, a keyboard melody and they'll, like, play off that, but.
Yeah, I listened to some of those tracks on SoundCloud. It's like a horror version of Stars of the Lid, which is cool.
Oh, thanks, man. Oh, it's just a lot of fun. It's, you know, really different. So that's it.
That's cool. So how did you get involved writing horror?
Horror's been, like, a big part of my recovery. It's really helped me out a lot. I mean, I've liked it ever since I was a little kid, and my mom bought me the Walt Disney Sounds of the Haunted House LP when I was, like, 7 years old. And I've always liked spooky stuff, but, like, when I got sober, I guess I felt that I needed like an outlet, you know, something kind of illicit or dark. And it just, I just naturally gravitated to it. At first I didn't even think about it. I just knew that watching a horror movie or reading something scary and intense made me feel good. You know, there was like an emotional release to it. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got into it. And I set out to be a horror filmmaker. My friends and I made 10 short films. They're like these silent horror shorts. Most of them are up on YouTube and Vimeo. Oh, awesome. So then I was writing a script, and I realized that writing was like my favorite aspect or my favorite part of the whole process. And then, so I was like, why don't I just, you know, try to make this into a book? Because I didn't really want to go through a whole process of gathering everyone together and getting props. And it just seemed like a lot. And that was in 2012. And, I found out about National Novel Writing Month. It's in every November, you know, it's like this organized contest and to see if you can write a 50,000 word novel in 1 month. And so I just took my script and went into the contest, and I think I made it to like 30,000 something words, and that turned out to be my first book. I completed it, and as a novella that I completed in 2015, that's when it was released, and that was called Joy. But that's how I got into it, and I just love it, you know, and the horror community is full of wonderful, like, you know, really kind, open people. And I've recently met some horror authors who are also Christians, and that's really interesting. And I didn't expect that, you know. But I love having this, be able to participate in this form where I feel completely free, and like I can say or do anything, you know, and I can just be as degenerate as I want to, and it's not like, you know, there's no one watching over my shoulder and saying, oh, you can't say that, or, you know, you can't decapitate that character, or, you know. And then bizarro horror is just a weirder form of horror. It's kind of like if David Lynch had directed the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you might get bizarro horror. Or actually, like, Eraserhead is kind of...
Oh, yeah, Eraserhead is pretty...
Yeah, that's often referred to as a horror movie, but that might be a bizarro horror movie. Or Bubba Hotep. Are you familiar? You know, that one, I would call that bizarro horror, because bizarro horror often has like a real comedic element to it, or an element, especially like absurd comedy or like dark, absurd humor, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I just love it.
Yeah, that's super cool. I'm like a huge horror fan, and it was interesting when I went to your Facebook page, and I was like, oh, he's a horror writer. That's awesome.
Oh, cool. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, man. Yeah, there's one book I wrote called Lucifer, and it's I personally think it has like it totally like shows like my Christian values that I was raised with, but I also put like upside down crosses in all the chapter breaks. But that's from you've heard of the Petrine cross where Peter was hung upside down because he said he was. Yeah, it ties into that story, and I'm worried that most people are going to be like, oh man, the guy from Joe Christmas is a Satanist now. You know, but like, it's like, I mean, I don't consider myself like a traditional Christian now, I guess, but then again, like, I can't like deny my roots, and like, I love like the things that Jesus taught and stuff, and so, but I don't know, I just wanted to tell you about that, because whenever I talk to someone like who's a, like a fellow Christian or from a Christian background, I'm always like worried that they're going to see that book and think I'm insane or something. But I wonder if people will get the true meaning, because if you read the story and like all the liner notes and everything, it all ties in together to make like a to function as like a whole, you know, mm-hmm. because it's about there's, and one of the elements is a religious government that's like really oppressive, but they make you like worship the government, and these kids try to rebel by using the Petrine cross, you know? Yeah. And, but it turns out that the government like owns all their thoughts, so they can't really rebel even though they think they are.
Oh, wow. It's a haunted mystery. It's a haunted mystery. It's a haunted mystery. It's a haunted mystery.
Thanks for listening to As the Story Grows. Our theme song was written and composed by the legendary Bob Nana. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes and give the show a rating and review. If you'd like to support the show financially, click on the Patreon link at asthestorygrows.com. If you enjoyed this episode, share it on social media with your friends. Much appreciated, and thanks for listening.